Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Fact, Patrick Mahomes is a very good football player. Mahomes? Fact, Mahomes is very good at football. Very, very good at football. Here is your warning. I've never been more convinced that Kansas City is going to repeat as champs than I am right now. There are other teams that I like. Some teams that I like a lot, which I'll get to. Except the thing about Kansas City is they just find a way, right? I mean, it's not like they dominated yesterday. It's not because of how well they played against Miami yesterday, because they certainly were not perfect. In fact, far from it. In the first 20 minutes especially. In fact, they weren't even good. They were flat out bad.
Not good.
Bad. Mahomes was a big reason for that, too. He had two picks. He had two sacks, including this on 3rd and 12 on their first possession.
Everyone knows about Andy Reid. Brian Flores is really ramping up. 3rd and 12, they got Mahomes. My goodness, that might be the sack of the year. Jerome Baker knocks him down at the 3-yard line.
How many yards? Jim, what's the sack?
Credit CBS. That's a 30-yard sack. That is some New York Jets bleep. Right there. Not defending champion, bleep. New York Jets, bleep. So for the first 20 minutes, they were bad. I mean, really freaking bad. But then came the next 20. Touchdown run, touchdown pass, punt return TD, safety. In other words, from down 10-0 to leading 30-10. And it happened that fast. Mahomes playing poorly. You've got them down double digits. One third of the way through the game, and you think, today is our day. We're going to get it done. We're going to win this game. And then all of a sudden, the Chiefs just wake the hell up. They throw the switch, and suddenly you're down 20 with less than a third of the game to go, and you have no idea what the hell just happened. You go from forcing Mahomes into chucking a pair of picks and taking 30-yard sacks to giving up 30 straight points. Like, they can hit you like the Golden State Warriors did back in the day, and then flip a game in a matter of minutes. They did it in the playoffs. They did it in the Super Bowl. And they're doing it again this year. So, if you want to beat KC, you better prepare to come to work for every single second of the 60 minutes and maybe on into overtime. Good luck with that. KC is so good that even a pick like this from Xavier Howard was not enough.
Found themselves down double digits like they did against San Francisco. Came back to win. Here's a toss.
Intercepted again. Howard has one. My gosh, Xavier Howard has now picked off a pass in 5 consecutive games.
He's playing the best in the secondary right now in the National Football League. I mean,
that's 9.
Incredible. Which is why we had him on the show recently. Incredible. And that play was a joke. A one-arm pick at the front of the end zone. That's the INT of the year right there. Or at least it was until Colts DB Kenny Moore actually one-upped him.
3rd and 8. Carr looking for it all. The rainbow. Oh, it's snared for the interception by Kenny Moore. Fantastic defensive play.
Kenny Moore. That was fantastic.
Holy crap, that was fantastic. The only way you can beat a one-arm grab on the goal line is with a one-handed grab in the end zone. That's not just the pick of the year. That is the pick of just about any year. That's the pick of just about any decade. A hell of a pick. And this was a hell of a catch from Detroit's Marvin Jones.
Stafford looking for Jones. Tight coverage. Marvin Jones pulled it in, but not in bounds.
Marvin Jones down the sideline. You get a little stutter go right here. I'm not so glad.
Man, would you challenge this
look
potentially?
This. I think that's both feet down.
I know the officials had ruled that an incomplete pass, but that's going down in my book as a catch. That's a catch. Because you know what's an awesome topic? Debating whether something is or is not a catch. So great to have that bad old days of that argument back again. Couldn't wait for that to come back. So no, I've never been more confident that KC is going to repeat than I am right now. I'm also never more confident than I am right now that Washington's Chase Young is going to be the Defensive Rookie of the Year. In fact, after seeing yesterday's game, I'm ready to give him that trophy right now. Against the 49ers yesterday, he had six tackles, a sack, a forced fumble, and this.
Takes the snap of the gun, fakes left, now has to cut through. Ball is out, a fumble picked up by Chase Young. He's running at the 45-40, has blockers in front of him. 25-20, 15-10-5, touchdown, Chase Young, touchdown Washington.
Chase Young, I mean, he picks that football up like an athlete, has it in one hand, holding that ball like sweetness, y'all.
That is the truth, too. Washington Radio, that is a very, very large man running very, very fast towards the end zone and carrying that ball like a loaf of bread. Normally, I would warn a guy about carrying a football like that, but this guy's hands are so huge, it doesn't even matter. Remember a minute or two ago as well when people started to talk about Joe Judge as a possible Coach of the Year candidate or Joe Judge as the next candidate to be Bill Parcells Jr., or Bill Belichick Jr., or Vince Lombardi Jr., or all of them rolled into one Jr.? I do, because as I stated on the NFL Today yesterday, all that Judge hype was maybe a little bit much given who the Giants have played this year, given who they've beaten this year. I mean, yes, they have won four in a row, or had, after that 1-7 start. So credit for not completely shutting down and going into the tank when others may have. But then again, isn't that what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to continue competing. As long as the checks are not rubberizing, you need to keep coming to work and doing your job. So that Joe Judge hype train was picking up steam, and then yesterday it jumped the rails, and it smashed into the valley down below after Arizona came into their house and punked them 26-7. Joe Judge got worked by Cliff Kingsbury and company. And it was a reminder that the Giants have been beating up on teams with losing records and a Seahawks team that completely overlooked them. But when you step in and step up against better competition, then you get exposed. And by the way, that wasn't even the best version of Arizona that did them like that in their house. And for all that talk of New York's defense and what they're doing and how dominant they've been, it was Arizona and Hassan Reddick who did the most work yesterday. This guy was insane. He had five sacks and three forced fumbles in one game. That's a really good season for most guys. And he did it in 60 minutes against the vaunted Giants. And he did it against a Giants offensive line that had been playing pretty well since that coaching fight. The coaching change. Listen, I'm not saying that Joe Judge is a terrible coach. Definitely not. But I'm going to have to see a hell of a lot more before I start crowning him some sort of coaching icon and legend that so many of you have already done. But if there is one legend that I am comfortable crowning right now, it's none other than the legend that is King Henry. After being held in check by the Browns last week, and I've got thoughts on the Browns, after being held in check by them last week, Derrick Henry broke loose against the Jags.
Run Henry at right guard, big hole, 30, 25, 20, 15, 10, 5, end zone. The Yulee Bulldozer, touchdown, tight.
Yeah, go ahead and tighten it up and bring everybody down. And guess what? Merry Christmas, Jacksonville.
Titans Radio. That run was part of a 26-carry, 215-yard, 2-TD day. That's his fourth career game with 200-plus yards, two touchdowns. That's a new NFL record. And he sat out most of the fourth quarter. If this guy had wanted to, he could have gone for 250 or taken a run at Adrian Peterson's single-game rushing record at 296. Hell, he could have gone for three Bills. But for a guy who puts up crazy stats, he doesn't really seem to care much about stats.
We can go 4-0 these last couple weeks. I'd be most happy. Like I said earlier this week, I don't care about stats. Really, last week, I was really pissed off by the way I played. Like, I played poorly, and I didn't do my job to help my team. So, you know, still pissed off about last week. And I just want to do my job to help my team and do anything I can to help us win. Really, stats really don't matter.
This dude sounds to me like, if I didn't know any better, I'd say that he's pissed off for greatness. But really, He's just pissed off for losing. And they got their asses kicked by the Browns last week. And he was going to make damn sure it did not happen again yesterday. Nothing but respect for the attitude and approach of King Henry. And nothing but respect for the attitude and approach of Brandon McManus. The Broncos kicker had a rough day. He missed a couple of extra points in Denver's win over Carolina. And you know how that goes. You know how it goes in today's game. If you have a rough game on the field, you are going to hear about it on social. And McManus certainly did. I've said it before, time and time again. Twitter can be a dirty, filthy, nasty place. And if you have a bad day, the Twitter gangsters, the keyboard tough guys, they're coming for you. Check out this tweet bashing him. Quote, Brandon McManus sucked today. Now check who tweeted that. At the kid McManus. As in Brandon McManus. As in Brandon McManus tweeted, Brandon McManus sucked today. That's how you own it. That's how you let the world know what you think of how you played. Nobody's going to be a bigger critic of you than yourself. Especially if you give yourself a Twitter account and the license to take a run at yourself. You did suck yesterday, Brandon, but I don't need to say it because you said it yourself. That's how you get in front of something. That's how you get out in front of something. And even better, my guy chased it with, quote, oh, snap, I thought that was from my burner account. End quote. Hell yes. Well done, B. Some guys get it. Some guys don't. He definitely does. Big hat tip to at the kid McManus. That's how you do it. Hey, clones, are you craving some protein after a good workout? This time, don't make a shake or eat a bar. Instead, grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why, you ask? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender and made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business. They take their smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating a shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, Teriyaki, Peppered, and Hot and Spicy. So the next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Make sure to look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. That way you can see the quality that you're getting. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, clones, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Antoine Bethea is my guest. Antoine, I want to say that it's been a minute or two since you and I have kind of chopped it up, but it's been actually like a decade, my man. What's up? How are you? How's life for you right now?
Man, it's been a while, but now I'm doing good, man. I can't complain. Obviously, during this crazy time, I'm healthy. My family's healthy, so taking them one day at a time.
Good, man. That's good to hear, and that's the way to do it. So you and Darius are co-hosting the Man to Man pod. How did that first come to be? And then how much fun are you having analyzing the games the way the two of you get to?
Man, it's it came during quarantine, you know, just sitting around the house, not having a lot to do. You know, Darius had the Everything DB show where he does a great job with that, where he kind of breaks down different coverages as far as the defensive backfield. And we just started talking, and we was like, look, man, let's do a pod together. Very knowledgeable of the game, and we can talk about other things outside of the game. And we came together, man, and we've been doing it for almost like 5 or 6 months and having a great time with it.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a great, great listen, too. So the two of you guys get to do your thing. Let me ask you about a couple of things from the weekend. Xavien Howard had himself a nice interception for the Dolphins. And any other day, Antoine, that would be the best pick of the day, if not the year. But what did you make of Kenny Moore's pick against the Raiders?
Man, spectacular play, man. And it was against a play that they run. A team's run a lot down in the red zone. We call it an ND7. You know, the coach used to run it a lot. And Kenny Moore, I guess he's seen it, came off, man, and that one-handed catch, man, was beautiful. Like you said, any other Sunday, Xavien Howard would have had the catch of the day. But Kenny Moore, man, back-to-back weeks with an interception, and he's doing some good things out there for the Indianapolis Colts.
Speaking of the Colts, they hammered Vegas yesterday. How does this Colts team then look to you on both sides of the ball right now?
They look real good. You know, obviously, I think the defense has been rolling all year. You know, I think on all three levels of the defense, man, they have some key playmakers, man, on the back end, on the second level with Darius Leonard up front. You know, those guys get after the quarterback. I think the defense has been playing very consistent. I think at some points during the year, it was just kind of like the offense or trying to find their groove. Yesterday, obviously, T.Y. got into the mix. I think that's what the offense kind of been missing from what they done in the past. So T.Y.'s doing back to his usual self. The young guy, JT, man, he's running the ball really well. And you got the savvy vet, Phillip Rivers, man, looks like he's feeling comfortable getting in his groove. So if they can continue to do that these last three games of the regular season and going into the postseason, man, they have a good shot at going far in the playoffs.
Antoine Bethea is joining us, breaking it all down. Now, you guys were also hosting the Overreaction Monday episode of the Man to Man Pod today. Darius was feeling pretty good about himself for predicting that Jalen Hurts was going to play big. And by the way, well, he should. What did Hurts show you and how he handled that moment against the Saints?
Man, and it kind of mentioned about Jalen Hurts and the things that he's kind of been through already. So, you know, obviously losing the starting job at Alabama, and then moving on and doing some good things in Oklahoma. So you can kind of just tell, like, his personality is the type of personality that you want leading that team. Obviously, the Eagles going through what they were going through on the offensive side of the ball, just struggling. And, during that time, teams are just looking for a spark. Coaches are looking for a spark wherever they can get it. And I just figured, D-Butt, he hit it on the head where he kind of figured it was like 4 weeks too late. But Jalen Hurts came in and gave that team a spark. You know, I think the guys around him rallied around him well, made some plays. He made some plays with his legs. And, that's what you need.
So where do you think that leaves Carson Wentz and the team going forward? Like, is this Jalen Hurts' team right now, or is it still too soon to say that?
That's tough, man. If Jalen Hurts is this season playing the way he played, obviously going against a tough New Orleans Saints defense. Personally, I thought it was going to be a tough outing for Jalen Hurts. But if he continues to play like he did yesterday, I think it's going to be put Carson Wentz in a tough spot. It's another thing that Darius been talking about. Like, okay, well, what do you do with Carson Wentz? And Darius say, Frank Reich, the relationship that he has with Carson Wentz, might see him in Indy. But I just say it's tough, man, just with that number, the cap number and that number that will come along with Carson Wentz, I think it's going to be tough. But, hey, we'll see. But I think it leaves Carson Wentz in a tough situation.
Antoine Bethea is joining us. All right, so what do you make watching the Steelers, Antoine, at the same time? You're watching them, and they lose two games in a row. In fact, two games in less than a week. What kind of thoughts do you have? Would you be worried if you're a Steeler fan?
Yeah. I mean, two losses in a row, going down the stretch, going into the playoffs, I would be worried. You know, obviously around this time of the year, you want to be playing your best football going into the playoffs. So if I was a fan, I would be worried.
I mean, like, when you look at their offense, what would concern you more? The fact that nobody seems to be able to hold on to the football right now, or that they can't run the ball more consistently?
I think it's the run game. I think, again, if you want to be playing championship football around this time of the year, you got to be playing great on defense and you got to be able to run the ball. And right now, they're not running the ball, and you can't expect Big Ben to go back 40 to 50 times a game and throw the ball down the field.
Talking to Antoine Bethea for a few more moments. And then on today's episode, which brings me to the Chiefs, Darius hit you with a question about Travis Kelce and where he would rank among the best tight ends that you faced. For those who have not heard it, who is the best tight end that you ever went up against, and what made that guy so good?
Man, I kind of put out probably like four receivers. I would say Gronk, Tony Gonzalez, I call him at the end of his career. Gronk, Aaron Hernandez, rest in peace. And Kelce is up there, and obviously George Kittle as well. But Kelce is up there, and just because of those guys, what they were able to do, just in the passing game. You know what I mean? And big bodies, they're able to, seal you off. What they can do after the catch, But Kelce, man, he's having a tremendous year. He's been having, he's putting a great run together as far as, you know, catches per season and yards per season. So he's definitely up there amongst top three that I've played against.
It feels like to me that he's getting better too. Kelce's unbelievable. I mean, the routes that he runs, the things that he's willing to do to help his team, he just seems like he's getting better and better. And then before I let you go, what about tonight? Cleveland is facing Baltimore tonight. This is an enormous game from a number of standpoints. You called your shot. You said it's going to be like a playoff game, and you do like Cleveland. Break it down for me. What do you like about the matchup for the Browns?
Man, I just think they're playing really well. They're playing really well. They have a lot of confidence. Baker coming off probably one of his best games as a pro. You got a two-headed monster in the backfield. They're doing great things. I think it makes the game easier for Baker. Defense is playing well. Myles Garrett coming off, rushing the quarterback. So, again, you know, it's a divisional game. I think it's going to be like a playoff game, guys. Both teams like to run the ball. Two good defenses, so things are going to be a good game, but I got the Browns coming out with this one.
Antoine, I agree with you, by the way, and I know Darius likes to pick the games. What do you make of the Browns? I mean, they were so impressive, I thought, and never mind the final score. They were so impressive in that beatdown they laid on Tennessee, but they're still not getting respect. They're plus three at home as a 9-3 team coming off that win. I mean, what do these guys have to do to get respect?
They just got to keep doing what they're doing, man. Just keep winning. Care less about the respect, man. You know, it's always about the people in the building that believe. Obviously, you know, with the new GM, shout out to Barry. He's doing some great work over there. But, you know, the guys just got to continue to do what they've been doing week in and week out. Go out there, play good football, and just get the W's.
Antoine Bethea, 14-year NFL vet, Super Bowl champ, and also the co-host of the Man to Man Pod. Antoine, good to have you back. Appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Nah, thank you, man. Appreciate you.
How y'all living, Bills Mafia? How is life for you right about now? Because your team just wrecked the Steelers in prime time. You're now 10-3. You've got a two-game lead in the AFC East. Two-game lead, three games to go. You are close enough to a division title to taste it. You finish this, and that'd be your first division title since 1995. For perspective, that title was 25 years ago, and Josh Allen is 24 years old. So I'll get back to Allen in a second. But first, a quick question. Let's go back to Pittsburgh. The hell happened to them? Because they were undefeated last Monday. Since last Monday, they have now lost two in a row. More specifically, what has happened to their hands? Manos de Piedra. Because Pittsburgh's receivers were dropping passes again, and nobody was doing it more than Deontay Johnson. He came into the game leading the NFL in drops with 10. And added two more before getting benched for most of the first half. Mike Tomlin had warned that that might happen, and in fact it did. And I can't blame him. You can't tell me those drops aren't in everybody's head right now. They are, and they're contagious. The best way to not drop the football is not to think about dropping the football. But it's impossible not to think about dropping the football when everybody around you is dropping the football. But last night was not just about the Steelers and their drops. It was about the Buffalo Bills and everything they're doing. Because like Kansas City earlier in the day, Buffalo did not come out well. They did not dominate from the start. In fact, they were pretty sloppy from the start. And you knew the haters were going to come out and crack on Buffalo. You knew the haters were getting all primed, all ready to take a run at the shiny, up-and-coming city of Buffalo. Getting ready to smack about the technology corridor. But then Taron Johnson changed all of that.
Roethlisberger from the shotgun throws left. Pass is intercepted by Johnson. Running along the far sideline inside the 30. 25-20. 10-5. Touchdown, Bills! Taron Johnson, his first interception of the season.
And that's a pretty easy interception and pick six by Johnson. Good break on the ball, but not a good throw by Roethlisberger.
Westwood won with the call and a 51-yard house job with less than a minute to go in the half. So from down 7-3 to up 9-7 heading in at halftime. This is how you flip a game. And then Buffalo came out in the second half and they just kept that flip going.
Second and nine for the 19. Pass to the left to Diggs. His man fell down. He's inside the 10 to the 5. Dives toward the goal line. Is he in? Yes, he is. Touchdown, Buffalo. It's 15-7 with 10:23 to play in the third quarter.
That is a grown man play by Stephon Diggs. Diggs won it. That was the Stephon Diggs drive right there.
Could it be? Might it be? My man, Ross Tucker, on the call. He's right, too. That was a grown man play. Diggs is a stud. This is officially the part where we need to give Stephon Diggs some love. Because when Brandon Bean made that trade with Minnesota, there was all this talk that he gave up too much for Diggs. There was all this talk that Diggs might have worn out his welcome with the Vikings. That he might not be the guy you want in your locker room. That even if you did trust him in the locker room, he might not be that big of a difference maker. Yeah, what about all that talk? It's all gone now because he leads the league in receptions. He's third in yardage. He's got 10 straight games with 6 receptions, and he dominated the Steelers last night. After the game, Allen was asked what changed for the Bills in the second half. His answer was simple, quote, "We started throwing it to Steph," end quote. That was a clinic from Diggs, especially in the third quarter when he had 6 receptions for 83 yards and a touchdown. The fact that he and Allen already had that kind of chemistry after the offseason that nobody had, or the offseason that went on the way it did, the fact that the two of these guys have meshed and have that kind of chemistry already is freaky. If this is what they're doing together after a pandemic offseason, what will they be doing a year from right now? Hell, what will they be doing a few weeks from right now? I know the answer to that question. Scaring the hell out of playoff opponents with that chemistry. Allen's arm, Diggs' footwork. And remember the questions about how he'd fit in with the team in Buffalo. Yet again, if I'm looking for the inside scoop on the Bills, the guy that I'm going to turn to is the Snowman. Deion Dawkins. Check out what the big dude had to say about Diggs.
Diggs is so special that as I see him play, I just want to rip off my captaincy and throw it on his chest because he's a stud, man. And he's been grinding. He's come in and he just continues to outperform, outshine, and prove us day in and day out that he's a different guy and that he's our guy. And I guarantee you, he's has gravitated to in Buffalo with an unbelievable love. And we can feel it in a locker room, how he plays, how he talks, how he walks around, how he respects his teammates. Like Stephon Diggs, he's gritty. And that's our teammate, and we love him.
You know, that's a respected NFL leader in a locker room. And that is actually the ultimate praise. You can't get any higher praise than that from a teammate. It does not get any better than that. So, are there any more questions about Diggs, about his ability, about his attitude? Yeah, that's what I thought. But the most impressive drive of the game was not the Diggs touchdown drive. The most impressive drive was the one which didn't lead to any points, but did seal the win. It was the one that started after Levi Wallace picked off Roethlisberger with just over 7 minutes to go in the game.
Roethlisberger has time, throwing long to the right side of the football field, and it's intercepted. Wallace picks it out of the air, falls to the ground, now gets up, running to the 40 on the near side to midfield, and he slides down at the 48-yard line of Pittsburgh.
I'm telling you, on day 4, great INTs. That was one more. Buffalo up 26-15 at that point. Pittsburgh never touched the ball again, and Buffalo did what winning teams do. They just ate the entire clock and never gave the ball back. So if the knock on this Bills team was that they had not beaten a legitimate contender, they did last night. Professional, impressive, pretty much like the entire organization. I could not be more impressed with them. They are legit. They're here to stay. They're going to do some damage. And then you got Josh Allen, right? Not his best game. But again, I could not be any more impressed with the way he handles himself, with the way he responds to any kind of adversity whatsoever. Man, they're all following this guy into battle. I love the Bills. And I love what I saw last night from them, especially in prime time and on a night where things did not start that well. He is Leonard Hamilton. Leonard, it's so good to have you. How are you?
Hello, Jim. I always like to hear that music that you play. as your introduction. I love it.
I love that. That's good. It's great to hear your voice there, Leonard. Great to have you back. Let me first ask you, the last 9 months, man, they have been something else, right? You've seen the NCAA tournament canceled. You've seen the season end abruptly. You've seen a pandemic. You've seen police brutality and the death of George Floyd. You've been around this game a long, long time. What have the last 9 months been like for you, and how have you gone about approaching them?
Well, there's no doubt that we've had a very interesting set of times that we all are going through. And Jim, I've tried to maintain a focus on the day and times that we're living in, and try to be in somewhat of a common voice, a very matter-of-fact voice for my staff, my team, and who we are. And it's been extremely challenging kind of going through the pandemic and facing that with some clarity, then dealing with the George Floyd and the racial injustices that we're dealing with and all the issues that go along with that. Obviously, watching the political unrest that we're dealing with and then end up having a very unfortunate collapse of an outstanding athlete in our game on Saturday. It's been a very challenging 9 months.
Leonard Hamilton is my guest, without question. Now, you mentioned that you beat Florida Saturday, but during that game, Gators forward Keontae Johnson collapsed on the court after a timeout in the first 4 minutes. I understand that you did not see it initially, but what was the entire experience like?
It was extremely emotional for both teams, and it was more than I had expected from our team, because we had several guys that have been with student athletes and other situations that they recall to their memory that some negative things have happened. So I had guys crying all over the place, and I was trying to maintain some level of calmness, not knowing the severity of what actually had happened, because I didn't visually see it. But the reaction from my players was extremely emotional, to the point where we had some guys that we didn't know whether or not they were going to be able to play after the timeout. My comment to them was, the only thing we could do was pray and hope that everything would be okay. And I had players on their knees crying and praying during that timeout, that unlike anything that I've ever witnessed before.
Leonard Hamilton's joining us. I mean, even specifically, like you said to Florida, that it was up to them if they want to continue that game. They decided they wanted to, but as you point out, it was also extremely challenging for your players to get through. How did you go about supporting your players throughout that game and then right after?
Well, to be very honest with you, as a coach, the fact that I had never experienced something to that level, you know, I as experienced as I am as a head coach, you, it's hard to fathom what it was like emotionally going through that situation. And obviously, our guys were shaken somewhat, and I thought it affected our play and our level of concentration as well as it did Florida's. I was not real sure that we were going to play after halftime because I think that Coach wanted to make sure his kids was okay. And from my standpoint, I wanted to be as cooperative as I possibly could under the circumstances. And, you know, that was just a game as far as I was concerned. But I think that it was my understanding that they wanted to play for the player who had the unfortunate thing happen. They want, in honor of him, they wanted to go out and compete, because they said, the word got back to me that he would have wanted to compete. So they wanted to represent him in a competitive manner. And I was really somewhat surprised that we were going to finish the half, but I wanted to be as cooperative as possible. And I realized the struggle that our players were having, and so it was obvious to me that his players probably had a little bit more of a challenge.
Right.
Yesterday, before our practice, we had we prayed after the game for him, and before we had practice yesterday, the first thing we did was have a word of prayer in his honor, hoping that he has a full recovery.
I appreciate your thoughts on that. Learn Hamilton is joining us, Florida State head basketball coach. Now, I know you're looking ahead, and you've got another big one coming up, but I would ask you to look back for one moment because you had such a special, special team last year, the kind of team that could not only make a Final Four run, but one that could win the entire thing. Obviously, you understand why the season had to end the way that it did, but how much did it hurt to know that your guys were not going to get even the opportunity to make that deep tournament run?
To be very honest with you, as disappointed as I was, I felt that it was the right thing was done, the right decision was made, because once that happened, you know, the circumstance surrounding what had happened the night before with the NBA canceling their games, and then we had a limited number of people that were going to be able to watch the game, it just made me feel uncomfortable that if we were limiting access to fans under those circumstances, then it didn't sit well with me that the virus would set in the seats, the empty seats. I just felt that it was unsettling to me once we got on the bus that morning going to the game, and I thought that it just didn't feel right, and that I didn't feel that that we would be playing. I told our staff, and then I was also skeptical even when we got to the arena. And then as we started our pregame talk, when they called me out into a separate room to have the conversation about the tournament being canceled, I was somewhat relieved because I was concerned about the fear of the unknown, not knowing what to expect, not knowing what could possibly happen. And then we finally had to tell our players, I just tried to make it very clear to them that life sometimes gives you these type of challenges that we have to deal with, and that it would be pale in the pleasure that we would gather and from competing in a tournament like this would be pale in comparison if something unfortunate was to happen to someone else. That we would have more games to play, more games to coach. But if something unfortunate was to happen to someone that was beyond our control, that it would not be something that we'd want to be proud of. So the right decision had been made, and we had to go back and collect our thoughts, not knowing that we were not going to be able to play in the NCAA tournament as well. But that's the challenge of dealing with sometimes the challenges that life will bring you.
Right. Florida State head basketball coach Leonard Hamilton is my guest. You know, really quickly, I would add this. You had two lottery picks in last month's draft, and Trent Forrest, who was signed with Utah as an undrafted free agent. But the really telling thing to me was that Patrick Williams was the fourth pick in the draft, and he didn't even start for you last year. So what's that say about the program that you have built and the culture that you have developed there?
Well, I mean, I think that we have kind of taken a page out of the old Boston Celtics book. I mean, Red Auerbach was a genius when he brought John Havlicek and Nelson and Zach Simons, all those guys off the bench. That was unconventional back in those days. Well, I'm in a conference, the best basketball conference ever assembled in the history of college basketball. So quite naturally, I have to do something a little different because I can't be like the tradition of powerhouses, the blue bloods in our league, by more trying to have a conventional starting lineup. So just like Fiondu Capengelly, the year before, was drafted by the Clippers, and he was not a starter, but they all my guys play starting minutes. So, you know, we win games by committee. We have 10 guys that are starting. We try to recruit to not have any players who can't play, and that's our system, that's our style. But people are locked in on who starts, but in our system, who starts is not as important as who finishes. So, you know, that's the philosophy we have. It's a little different than what other schools are utilizing, because they normally have their best players starting. Well, I want to have the best players. I want to figure out a way how to compete at the level with the conference that we're playing in. And it's best for us sometimes to have players on the floor at all times that are capable of helping you win, and that's our philosophy. And it wasn't necessarily that Pat Williams was not a starter. He just went on the floor at the beginning of the game, but most of the time he was at the end there finishing the game.
Well, as you and I have talked about, Leonard Hamilton, my guest, as you and I have talked about in the past, a lot of this is about energy and it's about effort and it's about a high level. And even Trent Forrest said that the ideal number was not 35 minutes a night, but 25 because of the energy required that you have to expend. Let me ask you about your freshman, Scotty Barnes, 6'9", on the wing, the highest rated recruit since you've been at Florida State. He's coming with so much attention and focus on him. What do you make of how he's dealt with all the attention and the transition he's made to the college game?
Well, he's a very humble youngster, and he still is developing because he's gone from being a power forward in high school to a point guard in college. And we think that's where his future is, and that's what we recruited him as. And so he's really finding ways to be effective himself with his skill set, but he's also adjusting to running the team, making decisions, getting everybody involved, and being a leader as a freshman on the floor with the ball in his hand. So it's a tremendous transition for him. So he's doing a great job because he's humble, he's unselfish, he's a pass-first kind of guy. He has high energy, plays with a lot of enthusiasm. He's a leader on the floor. And so he's making the transition, but he still has a lot more development to go. He is making the transition very fast.
Leonard Hamilton, my guest. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about one more person. Earlier this year, we lost John Thompson, and you've called him your rock, your confidant, your counsel, your friend. What do you remember about meeting him for the first time, and then what kind of an impact did he have on your life?
Well, when I first met John Thompson for the first time, you know, he really didn't know what to think of me. He probably didn't think very much of me, you know, because, you know, then I was the assistant coach at the University of Kentucky. But over time, I thought that we developed an unbelievable relationship where he became a mentor of mine. I called on him time and time again for fatherly advice and experience coaching advice. I watched him, as how he dealt with his kids and his demeanor and his thought process, and I learned an awful lot from him, and I could always depend on him to give me the wisdom that he had gained through his coaching experience. And many times, you know, as a young head coach, I needed to have someone I could lean on. He was very instrumental in assisting me in getting my first head job at Oklahoma State, and he's always been a pillar in my life, someone I felt that I could call on, and it was very, very traumatic for me to lose a guy who had meant that much to me.
He was a strong man, John Thompson. I had to chuckle, Leonard, when you said that when you first met him, he probably did not know what to make of you. If that was his reaction to you, you could only imagine his reaction to me when he first met me, because he was looking me up and down the same way, because he had heard me on the radio for a long time, and then he's looking at me like, you? That's you running your mouth about all those things? So I know he had the same exact reaction, but, you know, over time, I had to earn his respect. He was a strong, strong man, a man's man, wasn't he?
Well, I enjoyed every day I had a chance to spend with him. And he always said, young fella. He always called me young fella. And I one of these days, when I retire, maybe I'll share some of the wisdom tidbits that he gave me.
Yeah, I'd love to hear it. You've got, well, I mean, not for just me, not just for Cleveland fans, but for the entire country, for America, for our team. The true America's team, my Cleveland Browns. The beginning of back-to-back games on primetime television for America's team. Be grateful for what you get, but do not be fooled. Just because the Browns are getting the attention that they so richly deserve does not mean that it's a bigger game for them than it is for their opponent, because it's not. I made this point yesterday on the NFL Today. It's a big game for America's team. It's a bigger game for the Baltimore Ravens in the sense that they need it worse. They need it worse. You see, America's team is 9-3. They're not 7-5. The Ravens are. The Browns have won 5 of their past 6. They have not lost 4 of their past 6. Baltimore has. The Browns are the team coming off their best performance of the season, that beatdown of the Titans. Not a win over an organization which glosses itself as America's team and has a glass jaw. The Cleveland Browns are already going to the playoffs. As of now, the Ravens are not. Baltimore is the one that needs this game so badly, not Cleveland. You see, the Ravens need to prove that when they're healthy, they're the same team that put fear into every defense a year ago and finished with the NFL's best record. This is not a show-me game for the Browns, but it is for the Ravens. I'm here to tell you. And look, I'm here to tell you, I'm not hating on the Ravens. I understand what they've been through. Now, yes, there have been some weeks where they have looked like a shell of their former selves from a year ago. I'll say that. I'll stand by that. But they do still have ballers, and they've had some unfortunate things happen to them. you know, like a COVID outbreak. But the problem is the ballers that they have not been on the field this year. So when a lot of teams are looking to play their best ball when it matters most, a lot of teams are looking to gel right about now. The Ravens have been in the ice tub or in quarantine.
Ice.
COVID.
Ice.
Over a 10-day period recently, late last month and into December, they put 23 total players on the reserve COVID-19 list, including the 2019 NFL MVP.
Jackson.
Not only Lamar Jackson, but his two best running backs and several of their best defenders. And they have been decimated by injuries to key guys. They've had to scrap together players just to suit up. And until their win over the Cowboys last week, the Ravens squad that we've been seeing has been mostly running on fumes. Tonight, though, they are healthier than they have been in a while. And if they're healthy, presumably they are more dangerous than they've been in a while. Again, there is a reason they were 14-2 last year. Because they've got talent. Because they can run the hell out of the football. Because they can play some nasty D when they're right. No, they're not running it the way they were a year ago. But guess what? They still lead the NFL in rushing yardage per game. Lamar, rookie J.K. Dobbins, Gus Edwards, the man himself Mark Ingram, still pushing out 168 per game on the ground. And once they do get those favorable matchups off that run game, then Lamar can do what he does and torch secondaries if they bring too much help, like he did to Cleveland in week one. They put that beat down in Cleveland or on Cleveland in week one. Except this Cleveland team is not that Cleveland team. This Cleveland team right now is far from the team they were in week one. The Browns did a hell of a job last week as an example of stopping Derrick Henry. They held the guy who just went for 215 to 60 yards. Now, Baltimore's defense, the Ravens aren't as bad as their numbers suggest either. You'd think their run D is a weak spot. Not so much. Not when Calais Campbell and Brandon Williams are playing. And while they are banged up, it looks as if they will be out there tonight. And the Ravens are going to need as many big bodies as they possibly can get because you know the Ravens, although they might have the top-ranked running game in the NFL, guess who's number two? That's right, the Browns, with that two-headed monster of Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt. And you know I love Baker. You know I love Baker. And all you haters were wrong about Baker. But tonight would be a pretty good night to run the ball. Like they came out throwing it against Tennessee and torched them. Tonight would be a pretty good night to run the ball. I mean, Baker's already proven that he can lift that team up himself. But that probably should not be the blueprint. Just me talking here. Probably should not be the blueprint against a dangerous Ravens secondary. Tonight is game because they both run the hell out of it. Tonight, it's about what's going to go down the trenches. Tonight is a night the Ravens need more than the Browns. When was the last time you could say that? They need this game worse than the Browns. Things have changed now. America's team is legit. America's team is playoff bound. America's team is here to stay. The questions are not about the Browns. The questions are about the Ravens. The Browns are who I thought they were. Not we. I. I knew. Why do you think I've been banging on that drum so long? I've been banging on that drum forever. The Browns are who I thought they were. But who are the Ravens? We still do not know. But we'll have a better idea after tonight. Who you got? I know this. You know what the Browns don't have? As I mentioned earlier, respect. Not nearly enough. Not nearly enough if they're plus three at home, well, 9-3, and going up against 7-5 Baltimore. That's exactly how it is. Still not getting respect, even after that beatdown of Tennessee. Who y'all got? And then if you want to play the other side of that, who y'all taking? You like the Browns plus three? You like that? Or do you still not believe? Have they still not proven it to you? Love this game. Love this matchup. And I'll say it one last time. The Ravens need it more than the Browns. When was the last time you could say that? I mean, ever? He is Pete Thamel. He is back. What's going on, Pete? How are you?
Hey, Jim, I'm great. I'm great. Busy day in the college sports world. So this is why we do it.
I was going to say, and this is why I went looking for you, because it is a busy day in the college sports world. Give me a second, Pete. I want to lay this out. There's a lot to talk about in terms of coaching changes, but I want to start with the LSU-Florida game and the piece for Yahoo that had this incredible opening that you wrote, quote, "The University of Florida wakes up this morning with a throbbing hangover that most college students can relate to. It involves missing clothing, a toss shoe, regrettable words in the heat of the moment," from Dan Mullen, "and the searing types of headache and heartache that come with a night of regret," end quote. We all had college nights like that. It's a perfect summary. Take me back, though, before the game. What expectations did you have for that game? What did you anticipate seeing?
I anticipated Florida to win that game, 42-28. Like, I anticipated the Florida's defense isn't any good, and we'll be reminded of that in the SEC title game by Alabama, probably 50 or 60 times. But just the expectation was that Florida would be able to move the ball. LSU was undermanned. They played without Derek Stingley, their starting corner. They were down a couple other guys in the secondary. They only brought about 54, 55 guys on that trip, Jim. So, and they started a freshman at quarterback. So it was really just a flop on Florida's part. And that's, you can't call LSU untalented, but they were certainly inexperienced and undermanned.
All right, so then, Pete, late in the fourth quarter, Florida stops LSU's Cole Taylor on third down to force a punt until Taylor's shoe comes off into the hands of Gator corner Marco Wilson. Wilson decides to launch it down the field. What did you think when you saw that?
I mean, you can't make it up, right? Like, of all the ways to extend a drive and help a team win the game, that has to be in the top one percentile of bizarre.
Bizarre and certainly not the brightest thing ever. So the thinking had been that Florida was expected to beat LSU for all the reasons that you laid out. And then if somehow, some way they beat Alabama in the SEC championship game, they're in the college football playoff. Even before the shoe toss, though, how do you explain Florida no showing the way they did in that game?
Their defense had no-showed all year, so for most of the year, I should say, so they were always going to be vulnerable. And I never took their candidacy all that seriously, because I think Alabama is really just a step ahead of everyone else in the country, and I think two steps ahead of everyone else in the SEC. And the only thing Alabama's shown a weakness on this year is, like, the hyper-tempo hybrid Baylor stuff that Lane Kiffin runs at Ole Miss, and that is not what Florida does. So I didn't think Florida would be able to score with them against Alabama's defense. So although Alabama was in position in theoretical a college football playoff contender, and they're a very good team, they're a top 10 type of team, I just did not consider them a threat to go toe-to-toe with this Alabama team.
Pete Thamel is joining us. All right, so what does that loss then, the Florida loss, mean for the college football playoff? For instance, are Alabama and Notre Dame locked in at this point, regardless of what happens in the conference championship games?
So I can't see any scenarios where Alabama and Notre Dame don't go to playoff. Now, look, it's COVID. It's 2020. I'm not ruling out craziness, but I would think those two have to feel really good about where they are right now.
All right, so Pete, what about Clemson? If Clemson beats Notre Dame, they would be in. If Clemson loses a close game to Notre Dame, are they still in?
And what this did was really revive the case. Florida's flop revived the case for two-loss Clemson. And again, it's all subjective. It's all a committee. Like, there's really no way to firmly track it. Like, Texas A&M is 7-1, and they have a win over one ranked team, which is Florida. So if you go two losses to number two Notre Dame, and the thing about two-loss Clemson is they really don't have, like, a win over, like, North Carolina or someone who's, like, a solid top 20 team. They have that one win over Miami, which has kind of been consistently devalued this year as the Hurricanes have not lived up to their early flash. Look, I think that becomes a debate. That becomes a pretty intriguing debate that you can have a decent argument for both sides on. I think Texas A&M is a very good team, Jim. I don't look at them and say, wow, that's a playoff team. And then the other thing is, do you really want to see Texas A&M play Alabama again? I mean, Alabama curb stomped them earlier this year. So it was 52-24. It didn't even feel that close. And again, I'm sure there's some, you know, rule where the committee doesn't consider matchups and what they're doing, but like, you know, the college football playoff is really just a television contract, Jim, like masquerading as a playoff, right? So I do think at a certain point it has to sit in the committee members' minds of what would this matchup look like? Would people want to watch this matchup?
All interesting points. Pete Thamel is joining us now. Pete, the one team we have not talked about, the one program we have not talked about, at least not today, Ohio State. How confident are you that Ohio State gets in regardless of what happens in the Big Ten Conference Championship game?
Jim, I think they have to win. One loss Buckeyes would get an argument with you know, with the two loss Clemsons and everything like that, but they have one really good win against Indiana. I consider Indiana a damn good football team this year. I'm not apologizing for Indiana. They have proven pound to pound to be a very good football team. And I really look forward. I hope Indiana draws like a high-end team in a bowl matchup because I really want to see them tested against somebody outside the league. We're tainted by sample size this year, right, Jim? So it's just it's hard to say that. If Ohio State loses to Northwestern, I don't think they get in ultimately because they haven't played enough games. That argument's going to go there. And they have one good win and one decent loss. But A&M would have, I would consider, a better win and I would consider a better loss. So, I think Ohio State, you know, is the way it should be. Like, you win your conference, get that sixth data point, right? And they'll be in. But right. With one loss, there's an argument, but I don't think it's a great one.
All right, Pete, in terms of there being an argument, I'm going to pose the question, which doesn't mean that I'm going to make the argument, but I'm going to pose the question. If one loss Ohio State might get an argument from A&M, would a one loss Ohio State get an argument from an undefeated USC, or is that just not happening?
Boy, you know, I think Cincinnati has a better resume than USC. Now, they don't have, like, uniforms you recognize and, you know, a brand that pops. But quite frankly, Cincinnati, if they beat Tulsa to win their conference championship, will have their third win over a ranked team. The first two were decisive wins over ranked teams. USC does not have that. They have no wins over ranked teams. The Pac-12 just isn't very good. And Cincinnati will be playing its ninth game. USC is going to play its sixth game. Of course, we don't quite know who that's going to be against yet, so we can't determine what that would be. It's supposed to be Washington. Could end up being Oregon. It's the Pac-12. But USC needs to keep showing. Now, I think that comeback against UCLA, and it was a heck of a game and a heck of a comeback on Saturday night, I think that puts the Trojans on the cusp of the conversation, but I just think there's some traffic ahead of them. Also, like when you really dial in and have watched USC this year, they're just not that good. Like, they barely beat Arizona. They barely beat Arizona State. They obviously needed a kickoff return and a late drive to beat UCLA. Like, I just don't see anything elite about this USC team.
Talking to Pete Thamel, like I said, I will pose the question and not make the argument because I tend to agree with that. They did what they had to do. That was a great game Saturday night. But if you were looking or anybody was looking for me to make an argument for them over Cincinnati, it would be tough to do so. So there, Pete, have been a lot of coaching changes. Before the season, the thinking had been that because of COVID and the resulting financial issues, that schools would be a lot less likely to fire coaches. But there have been a number of high-profile changes. What do you make of all the moves that have been made?
Yeah, it made sense, and I wrote it before the year. And I wrote, feel free to mock me at the end of the year, but I wrote, like, there's going to be an institutional hesitancy to burn tens of millions of dollars to pay people not to work when universities are making conscious decisions all around the country to cut jobs, to save millions of dollars. But the bottom line is what I underestimated, and I think people around the industry underestimated, is just because these are COVID games and just because people are missing doesn't mean fans aren't going to be emotionally attached to the results. Does that make sense, Jim?
Yes, it does.
Like, just because these games, just because it's a COVID year, doesn't mean that Auburn fans aren't going to be miffed when they lay a dinosaur egg, like they have a couple times this year, including against Alabama. That no fan base has been like, it's a COVID year, we'll get them next year. That has not happened. And I think there was a presumption that this season would be viewed through a different prism. And I think in certain places it has. And I think like the lack of movement we're expecting to see, like in the Mountain West and in the MAC and places like that don't have the financial nimbleness that some of these bigger leagues do because of TV checks, that those realities have been prevailing. But at the end of the day, COVID is not going to be an excuse to not win, even though in some cases it's been a very valid excuse.
You know, Pete, I'm looking at Auburn, and when I saw this number, I had to double check it. I mean, there's a $21 million buyout of Gus Malzahn. $21 million. It would seem to me that if you're going to fire that guy and have that kind of buyout, and a chunk of that is like within 30 days, it's not like they can just stretch that out over 21 years. It would seem to me they would probably have somebody in mind to replace him. Do they?
No, they don't. And I wrote a column on Yahoo this morning that breaks down the candidates, Jim. And, you know, when that move made, I was kind of like, oh, they must have somebody. And when I called around last night, there was nobody imminent. And one of the problems at Auburn has existed since I started covering college sports 20 years ago is nobody quite knows who's in charge there. And so when you're trying to project who the next Auburn coach is, it all depends on who's going to make that decision. Alan Green's the AD there. He's a good young athletic director. But almost everybody tied to the Auburn search acknowledges that Alan Green doesn't have enough stroke to make the hire himself because, again, somebody has to fork over $10 million in the next month, right? So there's always been this dark arts of boosters and board and different things that go into decisions at Auburn, and I think you're going to see that. So it is a difficult one to forecast, but the only consensus I've gotten so far is they didn't have anybody ready. Like, there wasn't going to be a press conference in 24 hours. They didn't have anyone wired up. So we'll see where it goes from here. I mean, there was always, I had heard last week about back channeling for different candidates at Auburn, but like, you hear that every November and December, right? That's not anything new. Even when they're good, you hear about them back channeling to other candidates. So this time the move was made, and you know, for a school to hand over $10 million to Gus Malzahn, that's a lot of Waffle House, man.
Yeah, a hell of a lot without having a guy to replace him really quickly then. Pete, one of the names that has come up, and not surprisingly, Lane Kiffin. And we know that Lane has been willing to move to a new place after 1 year before. Could you see him doing it again? And might there be mutual interest?
Well, I would imagine, knowing how Ole Miss is wired, Jim, that they're scrambling to try to extend him, keep him, and all that kind of stuff. He's been very good for Ole Miss. They're only 4-4, but he's really made them relevant and brought his irreverent flair, is that maybe the best way to term it, to Oxford, and the fan base has really bought in. They've been interesting on offense. They're terrible on defense, but I do think they'll get better. DJ Durkin's a good defensive coordinator. So there's a path forward there, especially with the West maybe not as mighty as it was for Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss. I mean, the sheer spectacle of Lane Kiffin playing foil to Nick Saban for 365 days a year, or 364, and then playing him the other day, would be just the most fantastic theater of the next 4 or 5 years in college football. Like, it would, as a reporter, it would make me giddy. As a talk show host, it should make you giddy, Jim. That prospect is just scintillating. And if there's one thing Auburn craves, and this is kind of the second school syndrome in a state, you've seen it at places like A&M over the years, like, they crave attention. And nobody is going to bring them more attention than Lane Kiffin.
I think it would be one of the best things ever. It would be absolutely amazing. I agree with you, Pete. There's no way that Ole Miss lets him go without doing everything they possibly can to keep him. But, man, that would be one of the most amazing things. The way you laid that out, that's what that would be like. 364 days out of the year, except on that one other day when they played each other, it would be amazing. He is a national college football and basketball reporter for Yahoo Sports, co-host of Yahoo Sports College Podcast. Pete Thamel breaking down a lot of things for us. Pete, appreciate the time as always. Thank you very much. Great job.
Jim, thanks for having me.
Good night.